Bob Dodson has spent over 40 years traveling the country and speaking to men and women who have achieved something extraordinary with their lives, whether it is someone overcoming hardships to become a great success or someone who takes what they have and gives it back to their community. Dodson has become famous for giving these Americans a spotlight they so often deserve through his segment on NBC's Today. American Story, his new book, picks up where those segments end, telling a deeper story of these amazing people that Dodson has met, with details that certainly never made it to the air. Bob Dodson is an NBC News correspondent whose American Story with Bob Dodson is seen on Today and other NBC News programs. He's also the writer and host of Bob Dodson's America on the Travel Channel, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable. Bob, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
So how does a reporter get on this beat? Because it's a cool one.
I tell you, my grandmother would like to answer that question, too, because, you know, when I first got into the business, she was convinced that, you know, I was going to starve to death. And so when she finally got a chance to see one of these stories, I called her up and I said, "What'd you think?" And there was a long pause. She says, "I think you ought to learn a trade." She says, "They're not going to keep paying you for 3 minutes' work a week. You'll starve to death." But, you know, I joined NBC on a pretty big stage. I happened to be at the Olympics in 1972 in Munich when the Israeli wrestling team was taken hostage by terrorists and eventually killed. So, you know, I thought my path was going to be like everybody else. You just try to get to the anchor chair in New York City. But I bumped into some people along the way who kept telling me that, you know, we don't hear ourselves on radio anymore. And we don't hear our songs, and we don't see ourselves on TV, and we don't read about us. We read about everybody else, but not us. And the only time we ever stopped and paused to talk to ordinary people was when their children were down a well, or their house had blown away, or the snow was too high, and that sort of thing. So I thought, well, maybe this is the most underreported segment of our country, is you know, how we became who we became. Over the years, the theme of the book started to develop in that, you know, there was always a story on the surface that I was covering, and fortunately, most of them were fairly interesting, so I could keep my job. But I started to see a blueprint underneath all of that, and it was really a way that showed us how to create better lives for ourselves. And the point being that, you know, your uncle or your great aunt had already faced a similar challenge that we face today, and it solved it quietly without running for Congress, without tweeting, you know. So I said, heck, you know, rather than go out and just do feature stories on people, you know, funny, happy, good news, why don't we do investigative reporting on ordinary people to see what they've come up with? And so that's how the book started to develop.
How did it become, the segment become defined as American Story? Of these were actual segments that you were looking for?
Well, it started with lots of different names. The Today Show back in the 70s had a thing called Cross Country. And, it, you know, when I was younger, there were lots of Bob Dodsons floating around, and every newspaper had them, and NPR radio had them, and, you know.
Charles Kuralt being the most famous.
Charles Kuralt was the most famous. And, in fact, his great line to me when I was a young reporter, he came up to me and he says, "You know, all the money in the world is sitting on a stool in New York City, but all the fun is out there." And I took that to heart. But nowadays, you know, with social media.
So did he.
And so did he.
Yeah.
And his other great piece of advice is, you know, the people who sign your paychecks, never let them know where you are. That wouldn't work today because, you know, with social media, everybody knows everything, where people are. But his day, he would go off and disappear for 2-3 weeks at a time and do stories. And that's one of the reasons why we don't have this much reporting, because we live in an instant world. I mean, if you and I were riding along in a car together and the right front tire went flat, why, you know, you being in the media business would instantly have to start reporting that to the world. But fortunately, NBC for 4 decades has allowed me to get out and kick the other tires and wonder why they're still up, and why did the left front tire go flat, but how many more miles do the other ones have, and maybe we ought to shift them around a little bit. And so that became my beat almost by default, because as everyone else was falling by the wayside, it was just kind of like an open table for me to go out and do it.
And The decision, I assume, is ultimately yours as to what you're going to look for or who you're going to explore, the idea that strikes your fancy.
That's right. And, you know, a lot of times it's not so much, people ask all the time, you know, how do you find these people, because they turn out to be, you know, more interesting than they seem. And it's not so much the finding of it, it is as it is asking the right questions. And you certainly know that. I mean, it's what you do for a living. It's, you know, you can get beyond the cliche that people have, you know, become accustomed to telling other people about their lives, and you can find interesting things that may take you in a whole different direction. And so, I mean, all my in-laws are cops, highway patrolmen, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, that sort of stuff. And they told me when I was, you know, first married, that whoever speaks in an interrogation room first loses. Because they fill the silence with a better answer than you would even know to ask. So that's what I started doing. I mean, I went out to do the story that seemed to be on the surface. Like, for instance, there was a guy in on an island off the coast of Rhode Island called Block Island. And I kind of was intrigued because he was a 90-year-old state driver's license examiner. So if you're 16 in Block Island and you want to get a driver's license, you've got to impress this guy who's 90. Well, you know, I went and I shot the story on the surface, and it would have been a perfectly fine story, but we were waiting for the ferry to go back, and he filled the silence with a far better story. He said, you know, I came here at 8 years old as an orphan. And I said, no, I didn't know that. He says, I never married, but I lived with the Gerd Milliken family, and this was 82 years ago, and I'm still living there. I said, really? And he said, yeah. He said, and I've been the police chief, the fire chief, the head of the rescue squad. I started the baseball leagues here. I was president of the Chamber of Commerce 5 times. And, oh, did I mention the fact that I won the Rhode Island State Lottery? $500,000. This is why the ferry's pulling in, right?
Yeah.
So I'm starting to think, you know, maybe there's more to this guy. So, you know, and of course, the camera crew was kind of listening too, so they had quietly put their camera back up, and we recorded all this. And then he looked out at this big lighthouse on Block Island, and he looked back, and he said, you know, when I came here at 8, it was mostly farmland, and the Gerd Milliken family would go from Saturday nights to different other different houses on Saturday night, and everybody would brag on their kids. And one night, Mr. Milliken got up, and he pointed all the way past his 4 boys, and he pointed at me, this little kid at the end, and he said, you guys keep your eye on Fred Benson and see how he turned out. I said, wow. Mm-hmm. And then he looked out, and he came back to the camera, and he said, I hope he knows how I turned out. Police chief, fire chief, head of the Chamber of Commerce, on and on. So by about this time, one of the Milliken grandkids wandered by, and I said, where does he live in your house? She said, well, you know, he has plenty of money. He could have built his own house, but he went back to college. He got a degree at 54 so that he could teach shop, because he could see that the island economy was turning to tourism, and he figured we'd have to build some hotels. Then he threw the big party on his birthday and announced any kid who wanted to go to college, he would fund. And he's been doing that for years. And I said, yeah, but where does he live? And he says, he lives upstairs in an unheated room, the same room that he moved into when he was 8 years old.
Wow.
So, you know what I mean? There's always a story beneath the story. And I think it's true for all of us in our families. You know, you don't have to write a book about it, but if you just talk to, you know, Aunt Heloise, you'll find why you are who you are today. Because they've solved some challenge. And it just struck me that wisdom doesn't always wear a suit.
And but let us not forget your role in all of this, because certainly the ingredients are there, and many of us meet those ingredients at various aspects of our lives. However, what you are able to do in what is unfortunately a rather short period of time is to tell that story with great poignancy and make it lovely. And that is your real skill as a reporter, and also, I would add, as just a beautiful writer.
Well, thank you so much. You know, I think that, you know, stories only happen to people who can tell them. And I don't think the art of storytelling has changed much since somebody wandered down in the valley and killed a dinosaur and came back and painted on the cave wall. You should have seen what I've seen today.
Right.
You know. So I cherish that kind of opportunity. And, you know, Mark Twain has a great line. He says, I'm sorry this letter is so long. I didn't have time to write a short one. And so, I relish the challenge. I love the fact. I don't go back into the editing process thinking, oh, my gosh, I wish I had an hour. In fact, I'll tell you how I got the I got this job. That, you know, 4 to 5 minutes is gone with the wind length in the 21st century
right.
on network television.
Yeah.
But I got it by doing 59-second stories for a year when the Today Show only allowed a minute 10 for stories. And so, you know, every morning a reporter would call back in to the producer and say, can I have another 15 seconds? And, of course, they never could. Me, no matter what I was covering, whether it was a hurricane or whatever, I always brought it in at 59 seconds and gave them back 11 seconds. And then during the course of that year, I found a story, kind of like you now see on TV and would read about in the book, that, you know, could warrant a little bit longer take. And I came in and I said, can I have a couple of minutes? And, of course, the executive producer, who'd been watching this 59 seconds for almost 11 months, said, well, how about 4 to 5? And that's how I got my job.
Yeah. What is it like to have that opportunity to be, in some cases, at the end of the newscast, where there is that, where the anchor will look at us and sort of we as an audience just take that second pause before the end? To have that sort of that summation of the human experience.
Well, I think we miss a whole lot if we just do popular culture and people with power and money.
Yeah.
At the end of every news story or a newscast or at the end of any program, I think it's an obligation to remind people that the world is based on hope and inspire them that, you know, okay, everything else may seem to be going wrong and you're getting cancer and this, that, and the other. We've told you all this stuff for this whole 15, 20 minutes, hour, or whatever. But here's Dotson. And he's here to remind you that this country not only survives but thrives because of hope. And time and again, people would remind me that survival is not a question of being dealt a good hand. I mean, a lot of us gripe all the time about if I'd only been born to nicer parents or if I had more money, then I would make it. But these people would all tell me, and they're all throughout the book, that survival is not a question of being dealt a good hand. It's playing a bad hand well over and over and over again. And that's it. You read these stories, you hear the themes of what's going on in this book, and you see that's exactly. It's not what happened to them, it's how they reacted to it and how they pulled out. And that's pretty much the story of the United States. I mean, that's why we are who we are. And everybody around this country tells me as I go out and do these stories, we want a country that lives up to the brag. You know, the politicians always use that line, you know, the American people doing this, that, and the other. They're always speaking for us, right? But it comes out as kind of a brag if all you're really talking about is gridlock, right? And yet you go to Topeka, Kansas, or you go to, you know, Liberty, Missouri, and here's somebody who has quietly solved that problem. So I'm thinking, okay, day by day, in all kinds of places, people are living up to the brag. And that's why this country works, despite all of the things that we know that go wrong.
I thought about this often while reading the book, and that is, when did you become, and maybe it was immediate, I don't know, but when did you become conscious of the power of television and the impact that these stories would have after airing on the lives of the people that you portrayed?
Well, I had a news director when I was first starting out who gave me kind of an unusual insight. He said, don't just tell people or show people a story. Help them experience it, and then it lasts forever. And he was absolutely right, I came to find out, because, you know, a lot of times today when we report something, we just, especially in our immediate world with social media and all that, it's like the five facts, and that's it. And then there's no context. There's no this, no that. It's just, I know what's going on at the moment, but I don't remember what went on yesterday or what's going to go on tomorrow. And he used to always drum into us young reporters. He said, you know, people know what is, they think, and they know certainly what ought to be in their mind, but they're never really sure of what was. And what was is the most important part of that equation. So go out and try to build some context into this stuff. And that's when I decided to do what I do.
But you realize of what you're doing to the person, in the sense of by telling their story, millions of people are seeing that, and that in some way, shape, or form is going to have an impact on that person's life.
Oh, absolutely. I'll give you a perfect case in point. One of my favorite stories was about a Philadelphia beat cop named Bill Sample, who was stationed at the Philadelphia Children's Hospital, and he was around all these kids who had terminal illnesses. And he realized that the kids and their families, the only memories they had was, the hospital. So he asked the doctors if a little boy wanted to go out and have a snowball fight, if he could take him out and have a snowball fight. Or if they wanted to go and meet Batman, he'd find somebody in the neighborhood who looked kind of like Adam West and then find somebody else who could make a Batman costume, because mm-hmm. he was all mom-and-pop kind of set up. And he'd come back and play that for the kid. And he was in his 40s. He'd never become more than a beat cop because he never took a minute's worth of overtime in his entire career, because he spent the next 8 hours of his day every day fulfilling wishes for kids. And this was before Make-A-Wish and all that sort of stuff. When I called him up, I'd heard about it from a friend of mine, and said, I'd love to do this story about you. He had this poignant answer. He said, well, right now I can present the wishes that children have for every kid that I bump into. And he says, I'm not the American Cancer Society, nor do I want to be. And if I got $2 million in donations and had a staff, what happens if I get $5 million worth of requests? And I said, Bill, listen, there's a lot of people out there who have good intentions, but they think they're the Lone Ranger, so they don't try. You've not only tried, but you've done it for so many years, and you've never even called the local newspaper or the radio station to do a story on you. None of that. And I said, I think that'll be an impact on lots of folks. So he decided to do it. He did it. And consequently, he ended up, after he retired from the police department, starting a little thing called the Sunshine Foundation. He's helped thousands and thousands of kids since then. And a lot of wannabes like the Make-A-Wish and all that have picked up on that same theme. But it all started off with one guy just doing what he could. And isn't that pretty much a metaphor for this country?
Yeah, it's beautiful. And you also, it begins a relationship that it seems through reading the book that you often maintain with people down the road. These are people that do not leave you easily.
Well, they don't. And I think it almost in every story, at some point, I end up doing the story for them and not for the 5 million people who are going to see it. I mean, I don't want to, because I figured this might be their only shot at having what they've done, their immortality or whatever, be remembered. And what I love about most all of them is their humbleness and their gratitude. Not gratitude to me, but I mean, they're grateful for the life they have and for the fact that they've been able to come up with a solution that works for them. And then they're humble. They don't wave the flag or themselves. And so, you know, the people that I do stories on become my best news sources. They're the people through the years who've come back and said, you know, hey, Bob, I just was on vacation and I saw something else. And they understand that it's not just the story, but it's the story beneath the story that makes it, you know, memorable. And I give a perfect case in point. There's a guy that out in Washington State still lives there, and he's a photographer. And he got not just one thing, but two things done in his life, which really changed the whole world. The first was that he saved a stand of trees who were older than the first kings in England and France, and they were about ready to be cut down. And the Sierra Club, nobody could save it. So what he did was he took a rope and put it around one of the biggest trees and then sent it to the insurance company back in the East Coast to the president and said, just put this out around your meeting room. This is the tree you're cutting down. Well, of course, he saved the forest. The second thing he did was he got one of our most recent national parks. He worked 12 years to get the new Lewis and Clark National Park. Mm. And he also found out in the process of his part-time research that, you know, where we thought Lewis and Clark had actually seen the Pacific was in the wrong place. So he did all of that. At any rate, so they get down to the point where they're going to be opening the park, and President Bush, the younger, was there at the time. And all of his friends started emailing me saying, he hasn't been invited. Well, your point of view and my point of view, that would be unconscionable. So I call him, and he says, well, that's by design. He says, you got to understand, he says, in order to get power and money to get something done, if you have no power and have no money, you have to play to the conceit that these people who sign paychecks or who are in powerful positions actually did all the work. And I'm thinking, okay, there's a story on the surface of what this guy did, and then there's the blueprint of how he did it. And he gave me a great example. He said, you know, if I stood up next to President Bush and all the senators and all the people who had, you know, come in at the last minute, then those folks who live or die to be on television and radio and have their pictures in the newspapers would see the conceit of the fact that they didn't really do this, and they'll back away. So at the last minute, you lose money and power. So he says, I try to keep on focus. What I want to get done, I want to get a new national park, or I want to save this forest. And he says, so I went at this problem as if I were trying to teach my young son how to ride a bicycle. And if you think of money and power as the little training wheels, he says, once you've taken them off and Timmy goes off across the church parking lot riding the bike, you wouldn't think as a parent to run alongside and wave to everybody on the street, hey, look what I did. I taught Timmy how to ride the bike. Because, of course, Timmy will ride away and never ride that bike again. Right. He says, it's the same thing with money and power. He says, once you've attracted them to your idea, step into the shadows and applaud. And I'm thinking, okay, there's the story, thousands of stories that I've done like that. But then there's also this wonderful, wonderful takeaway blueprint of how you get something done. And that's why these stories become so memorable and they last. And, you know, people can't remember what was on the news last night, but I get letters and emails all the time, and they're telling me about some story that ran in 1990 or 1975 or 1983, mm-hmm. because not necessarily just the way I told the story, but the fact that these are fundamental stories of America. And it's told through the most interesting prism you can find, which is people who look a lot like us.
That's what makes the book so much fun, is you get to revisit many wonderful stories that you haven't heard about for a long time. American Story is the name of the book, a lifetime search for ordinary people doing extraordinary things. Bob Dotson, I've been a fan of your work for a very long time. It's quite a thrill for me to have the opportunity to speak with you. I wish you nothing but the best of luck with the book and future projects.
Anytime a reporter gets more than a minute 10 to talk, we're friends.
Excellent. Bob Dotson, I thank you very much, sir. It's a great pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book, American Story, A Lifetime Search for Ordinary People Doing Extraordinary Things. The book is published by Viking. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.